So, Ed spoke a little about the role of the humanities as opposed to the sciences, and we talked a little about that distinction. And I think I'll pick up on that a little bit, especially like the possibilities thing, the possibilities of different ways that we can sort of relate to the world around us. You worded it as, or one way that you put that importance was value questions. And I think that what a value question does that the sciences do not do, or that disciplines outside the humanities in general do not do, is try to orient us in relationship to the things around us. The sciences attempt to give a picture of things sort of as they exist, sort of irrelevant to us, as things are just sort of in the world, objectively. Whereas I have a professor who described literature studies as, I really liked his description. It was like diving into layered subjectivities. Like when you read a book, you're getting into the character's mindset. When you read a poem, you're letting that affect you, and you're letting the emotion that's attempting to be conveyed through the poem sort of like change the way you orient and shape your relationship to the to whatever the topic of the poem might be about. The fine arts in general do this. I think mythology and sort of like classics as a discipline, looking at these different perspectives, these different narratives, these different stories, they work to shape our relationship and our involvement and our modes of engagement with the things around us, which is really significant, because if we're trying to sort of change our relationship to nature, if we're trying to change the way that we interact with and behave within the natural world, then we need those sort of new stories. And speaking of stories, a couple of you were at the walk last month that was led by myself and Shane Doyle. And I spoke there a little bit about the difference between an explanation and a story, which might be useful here to again clarify the different sort of goals of the explicit goals of the humanities as opposed to the sciences and their relevance to us. So I talked about an explanation as just sort of the direct neutral transfer of information, that this is why something is, this is how something is. Whereas an explanation, at least not explicitly, at least not consciously, doesn't put you into a particular relationship with whatever it's talking about. It's describing that thing outside of you. A story, on the other hand, will put you into a certain relationship with those things. And so whether that story comes in like cultural studies, which tries to shift our relation, like change the stories we tell about power and oppression, or sort of philosophy, which changes the stories we tell about our basic assumptions, or our sort of ethical starting points and things like that. There is always this explicit sort of goal to shift that orientation, to change something in us and in how we relate to the things around us. And so one particular way of doing this, which I think we'll explore a little bit today in some detail, the next stop we'll talk about wonder in particular, but I want to begin with enchantment. And now, thinking of that notion of relationship, when I talk about being enchanted, or that something is enchanted, or that you are enchanted, what does that mean? Because the dictionary gives a really bad definition, and I have some like definitions of my own from a few people who have written extensively about enchantment. But the dictionary definition is to be under a spell or to feel joy. So that seems pretty insufficient for our purposes. So I guess if anybody has any associations of what does enchantment mean?
It means I'm part of a song, right? Mm-hmm. I'm in the chant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a literal etymology or not.
It is, actually, yeah. Chanter, the French, like chanter, or however you pronounce it in French.
Okay.
But yes, and cantos, the Latin cantos, to sing into. Enchantment. But yeah, any other associations of what enchantment might be? What might it be as an orientation, as a way of relating to things?
I'd say fully immersed in something.
Fully immersed. Interesting.
I think, you know, sympathy, fellow feeling, or whatever.
Fellow feeling. Thoreau?
To a certain extent.
Yeah.
I suppose, yes. But, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, I like that.
Also, being drawn into. It's like it's an enchantress put you into a spell. So it's not necessarily yourself doing that or just viewing something, but rather being drawn into it.
Mm.
There's also a sympathy thing. If I look at a tree, I somehow, at some level, some vague, weird level, I get the sense that the tree's looking back, and there's communication there. That sounds really weird, but it's sort of there. You know, when you study something for depth, you kind of feel that way toward that for a while. That's an insufficient way of describing the sensation, but...
What's interesting about these different descriptions is that they all seem to imply participation, belonging and connection, and seem to apply some kind of like activity or action on the part of the things around you, like being drawn in. That puts the agency on the thing itself to draw you in. To be like, someone else said something too that made me think of participation, and of dialogue. And so that reflects. So Sharon Blackie is an Irish mythologist and writer who writes a lot about enchantment. And one of the things she says about enchantment is that it always engages a participation mystique, is her form for this sense of this sort of mystical or mysterious sort of sense of connection with something else. That's part of the experience of enchantment. And again, to point out this distinction. Of when we're talking about, you know, when we're using words like magical and mysterious, to keep in mind the goals of things like of you know, what we talked about, that difference between story and explanation, that enchantment does not involve magical thinking. It doesn't involve believing that the world operates according to a certain set of mystical principles. What we're trying to articulate, I think, is what being enchanted as an orientation, as a sense within yourself of how you relate to the things around you, of how it feels internally, there feels to be that participation mystique. And also there's a couple other, ignore the fact that I'm swiping and poking my journal here. So Jane Bennett is another philosopher political philosopher primarily, who writes a lot about enchantment and the role of enchantment. And she describes the sort of experience of enchantment in a couple ways. She says, to be enchanted is to participate in a momentarily immobilizing encounter. It is to be transfixed, spellbound. So it's sort of that moment of total immersion that you were talking about. She also says, the overall effect of enchantment is a mood of fullness, plenitude, or liveliness. A sense of having had one's nerves or circulation or concentration powers tuned up or recharged. A shot in the arm, a fleeting return to childlike excitement about life. So, in talking about what this orientation of enchantment might look like, might feel like, I would hope that there would be some intuition about how this could relate to how we feel about and behave within the natural world. That being enchanted and cultivating enchantment through the use of the fine arts of poetry, of music, through reading and enriching ourselves through literature and mythology, that we can cultivate this sense of enchantment, which may aid us in behaving more justly by having a deeper fellow feeling with the things around us. And actually, J.R.R. Tolkien has a great quote. So Tolkien wrote a very underread essay on called On Fairy Stories, which is a remarkable essay on sort of defending the virtue of fables and fiction for adults as well as for children. And he writes something interesting that I think hints at the relationship of enchantment to nature. He writes, "Fairy, the world of fairy, contains many things besides elves and fays, and besides dwarves, witches, trolls, giants, or dragons. It holds the seas, the sun, the moon, the sky, and the earth, and all things that are in it, tree and bird, water and stone, wine and bread, and ourselves, mortal men, when we are enchanted." So there's this implication there that by shifting that orientation, by enriching yourselves through mythology, through fine arts, through sort of engagement and opening yourself up to those different modes of being, you kind of enter into this other world that becomes the world around you. And that's like quite a remarkable experience and description to me, I think, of what that could be like. But in any case, those are my preliminary thoughts on enchantment. I think the next stop will sort of try some exercises in wonder and in getting us sort of engaged in that mode and what that might feel like. But for now, I'm curious to hear anybody's thoughts about enchantment and maybe particularly the role of the humanities and the role of culture, the role of engaging with this sort of world of thinking that can shift our orientations and the role of that intellectual world in sort of fostering a more enchanted experience or predisposition.
Enchantment comes from within.
So this is an interesting question, right? Is enchantment, are you enchanting the things around you, or are you enchanting yourself?
Right.
To see them differently.
Probably yourself.
I think it's yourself. I think that enchanting, which is why I think the humanities can say something about it, because, and maybe I'm being too limiting with the humanities by saying humanity, because I think there are other, like philosophy can give a lot to the sciences too, but I still, fundamentally, I feel like it has something to do with relationship, and relationship therefore always has to do with you, and how you are in the world, and so. So yeah, I think that fundamentally it's shifting how you see things, more so than trying to determine that they are different. Because if we're trying to determine if there's a dryad living in that tree, and we're trying to determine it from a scientific perspective, we would take a very different strategy than if we're trying to determine it from a humanities perspective. Because we wouldn't really be trying to determine it objectively. We'd rather be trying to see what cultivating the experience of the dryad that I'm going to now believe and experience as living in that tree, what that feels like, what that does for me, what that does for the way I behave in the world. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think that...
Yeah.
Do you agree with that, or...?
No, that's a great explanation of the feeling of a person would have, that I have, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that in some cultures and stuff, there's, like, less of a separation like between, like, scientific thinking and, like, in humanities and stuff? Like, I don't know, I think about maybe some like indigenous cultures and stuff where, like, you know, mm-hmm. it's more blended. Like, I think about, like, this guy, Louis Lindbergh, he has this idea that scientific thinking originates with tracking, wildlife tracking, because mm-hmm. he has inductive and deductive reasoning, and he has this whole theory about all about it, yep. and it's really interesting, and because like, you look at the evidence on the ground and all around you, and what you have, and you create a story, then also, like, you know, you might have less evidence, and then you have to create a hypothesis and then test it, and then you know, especially back then in certain times, like, if you're wrong, then you might starve, you know, might not have food. And I don't know, I'm kind of wrong, but like certain he works a lot with the Kalahari people in mm-hmm. South Africa and stuff, they kind of entwine like storytelling and imagination and all that stuff, and like putting themselves kind of into the animal's perspective to think of things. Mm. It seems like almost like a combination of like science and...
Yeah, I actually completely... I think you're spot on with that. I think that the separation between scientific modes of thinking and sort of the humanities and orientation and shifting our relationship to it, I don't think that they're separate in most cultures besides for our Western culture. And I think that there's some remarkable examples of... I mean, people think about mythology as sort of fanciful or as not really relating to reality or as sort of half-hearted explanations of reality, maybe, which is, to put it totally in the failed science category rather than recognizing the sort of relational and moral capabilities of mythology. But I think that it's definitely a combination because, as you, I think, mentioned... indigenous cultures that survive on the land cannot afford to be fanciful. Things need to be pragmatic. They need to work. They need to aid in survival. And myths did this not just by, for one thing, they did this by encoding scientific information, by encoding information about the land. In Polynesia, there's a lot of stories about islands being fished up by like Maui or other culture heroes. I think it's mostly Maui from Hawaii to New Zealand, but, there was a recent study by Patrick Nunn that showed that the islands that have been fished up are the islands that were formed by volcanic eruption. And so there's this carried history of the information of how those things were formed. There's another great example in Australia of the Dreamtime songs of Aboriginal people. And Dreamtime, so these are chants that of how the ancestors, the Altaringa Michina, the dreaming ones, traveled along Australia. These, like, there's like a rainbow serpent, there is another giant, the Jengawal, I think. But they walked and formed the different contours of the land. So, like, where one urinated, there might be a drinking pool. Where one laid down for a nap, there might still be a mountain. So what's fascinating about it is, first of all, this carries information about the land. But second of all, it actually creates a sonic map of the continent of Australia that is enchanted with all of these forms and how we should relate to it morally. And when the singers of the Dreamtime chants would act as guides, and they would walk, travel along these paths, and the songs would be such that they would sing it, and as they're singing it, walk and be seeing the things. The songs actually did form a pathway that alluded to different things. And this was also, I mean, there's a lot more to talk about there about how those songs were taught and transmitted too. But in essence, yeah, it's like mythology carries a lot of scientific information, but it never loses that sense of relationship to this information. Like, our science attempts to step outside the world to describe it as if it exists outside of our experience. Mythology never loses the inherent human experience, and so it always implies those moral lessons too, but it has to be constantly updated given how to reflect the actual world too. So there's definitely, I think, a lack of separation. I'm sorry if I went off for a long time on that, but you just touched on something that I feel very strongly about too, and I'm glad you brought that up.
It makes me think of, very briefly, I know we should probably move a little bit for blood circulation, but I'm wondering if there are certain types of sciences that might lend themselves more to, I guess, embracing the mythological. And I'm thinking of a writer, Lauren Isley's The Immense Journey. It's an absolutely beautiful book. And he's coming at from a kind of a naturalist, ecologist perspective that is, like, the entire book is like reading like a book of poetry, and filled with scientific facts and knowledge. It is absolutely unbelievable. So and then there's other, I think, types of science that perhaps I, or maybe even just individuals within that field that I might not see that as much. I guess I'd be curious to see if you had any thoughts about on your readings, if there are ones that I guess tend to be a little more open to the story, I guess, aspect.
I think that, and I'm not, like, I may not be the best person to answer this question, but it seems to me less like it's about different kinds of science, and more about what is being studied within that science. So, like, for instance, some things in biological science might not lend themselves easily to being framed in a mythological context or with a sort of, like, with our relationship, but I think basically, if it's related to us, if we encounter the thing that we are talking about scientifically in our direct experience and to have a felt sort of body, like bodily relationship with that thing, so like maybe talking about the role of the microbiome in the production of a certain kind of hormone or something, might not be something that it lends itself as easily to mythology, though I think it also could be. But if we're talking about the role of fires in forest conservation, then maybe there's something a little more like felt and present to talking about ourselves in relationship to that. But I think that I wouldn't put a hard line, but I would say that, even things like physics, even things like we're talking about, like the Big Bang, that lends itself, that's cosmology, and cosmology really puts you in relationship to the fundamental structure of the cosmos, and that's sort of outside of our felt experience. So maybe that's not totally true, but I think that having a relationship to the thing being studied, the stronger that relationship to our experience may be, the easier it is to apply to bring in those perspectives or combine
them. You talked about mystery in your little prepared shtick, right? And there's two different meanings of the word mystery, right? There's mystery is like an Agatha Christie novel that you just need to solve a problem. And then there's mystery in the sense of like religious mystery, where you're not solving anything, you're being immersed in something. The point is not to solve it. The point is to live it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so to the extent that we're doing the second thing with our mysteries, we're being enchanted.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that we're doing the first thing with our mysteries, we're not.
Right, I agree.
Right?
I think
but
that
which kind of mystery are we engaging with?
You could be doing both.
I think absolutely you can.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make this like a hard and fast
no.
one or the other. But yeah, absolutely.
But drawing that distinction
this whole time.
Drawing that distinction, I think, is good because if you mistake if you lose sight of the second kind of mystery, if you're not welcoming mystery, actually, Sharon Blackie has four what she calls the major components of enchantment, and one of them is enchantment incorporates feeling, which I was going to bring up the next stop, but I can read it now. It incorporates feelings of wonder and curiosity. To be enchanted is to be comfortable with the fact that not everything can be explained, to tolerate, even welcome, the presence of mystery. That's like necessary to feel enchantment. It's not just,
I could stick in one more issue on science. Every year I get a lot of people up at the fire lookout who look out and say, God, this is beautiful, looking out at the Chinese Wall and the mountains in the wilderness. And somewhere along the line I'll say, well, are you interested in the geology?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is. And what I've really come to realize is it's a fiction. It's something we've put together. We've made that. It is a fiction. And it's also a mythology. Because it's like Joseph Campbell saying, all mythologies are creation stories. And so by the time they leave, I've had people just turn around and say, this is a whole different place to me now.
Mm.
Just because of, I'm saying you're standing on billion-year-old rocks. They're all made of microforaminiferous skeletons, that kind of thing. And it just it brings something alive to them about what they're seeing. So I feel like the aesthetic dimension of science is something.
Yes.
And Lauren Isley is a poet of science, and that's why he's so wonderful.
That's actually something that I forgot to mention when I was first bringing up this notion, when I was trying to distinguish between the humanities and the sciences. I mean, one thing I wanted to acknowledge was that the sciences absolutely have the power to cultivate enchantment, but they don't do it by explicit intention. That has to be taken, and then like a sort of, I guess maybe a humanities perspective, some writerly sense of how to put those things together needs to come into the picture in order to present it in a way that tells a story,
exactly,
that enchants. But absolutely, science is a rich ground for that experience of enchantment. Also, what you said about it being a fiction put together, that these explanations and words that we're attaching to the history of this mountain is really just human symbols that, you know, it reminds me of Ryan brought a few months ago on a talk we gave, introduced me to this great Nietzsche quote that I don't remember the exact quote, but to paraphrase it was like, to call a deer a mammal is to say nothing about the deer itself. It's just to say something about us. Like, it doesn't, like, the deer, it's irrelevant to the deer itself. To what it is an actual thing, it defies any label or explanation. It's just a deer. Or rather, it's not even that, I guess. I mean, it's a whole essay on language and what language signifies, but, yeah.
Another cognition is, the kangaroo can jump incredible. It has to jump because it's incredible.